Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugufu peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noongar, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, today we're talking about an Aboriginal community or First Nations community that was established back in the 1880s, early 1880s, I think 1883, I think. Its name is Corranderk, about 160 miles or so out of Melbourne, at where Healesville is situated, or in that area. And this is an amazing story. And I'm talking to one of the writers, Giordano Nanni. The book that he's written with First Nations woman Andrea James is called Corranderk, We Will Show the Country. This book, there's also been a play has been created by the First Nations arts mob down there in Melbourne, Ilbijerri mob. The fascinating thing about Corranderk is that it was reserved land. The government had reserved land, so it was a mission, a reserve. But it was a farm. They farmed hops. And it was virtually self-sustainable. Very small community. I think it grew to about 150. Started off with about 40 workers and grew from there. But it's an amazing story. And I've got, talking to me on the phone, is one of the writers, Giordano Nanni. Giordano, welcome to the program. How are you?
G'day, Tiger. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, also for your warm welcome to Country and Elders. It's good to be here.
It's certainly good to have you on air with me today. How did you come to write the book?
Look, it's been an interesting journey, a long journey. It's been about 4 years. The book, as you mentioned, is derives from a play, a theatre production, which has been put on by Ilbijerri Theatre. And it's played before in Melbourne and the Sydney Opera House, and it's about to open at the Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney on the 11th of December. And the book basically is the publication of the script, which I edited. We're often referred to as writers, but it's more correct to say that we're editors because all the script is really derives from the transcripts of an inquiry that took place in 1881. So all the words that you hear in the play are the actual words of the Corranderk community, both the Aboriginal residents and the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. So you kind of get to hear the actual voices. And the book also contains a history of the Corranderk Reserve, which you just gave an overview of, and of how the play was made. And to answer your question, the play was made, as I said, we started about 4 years ago. I came across these transcripts of this inquiry in 1881, and I was really fascinated by the content, the strength of the Aboriginal voices, the humanity of the voices of people like John Green, who was the manager with whom the Corranderk residents founded Corranderk and with whom they worked side by side. And also the words of Anne Bonn, who was a wealthy Scottish woman who supported the Corranderk community in fighting to retain hold of their land. And I thought how amazing it would be, you know, well, firstly, how sad that these voices are here sitting in the archives where no one really knows about them except for historians. And how awesome would it be if we could get brilliant actors to reenact this inquiry? And that idea resonated with quite a few people. And a team came together, an amazing team of people, firstly, of course, Andrea James, who is a brilliant playwright, Yorta Yorta playwright, with whom I edited the transcripts. And then Rachel Mather, who is the artistic director of Obidjeri, and Isaac Drandich, who directed the performance. And then researchers from the University of Melbourne, with whom we put together a grant application from the Australian Research Council, which paid us, Paul, paid a lot of money to put together a project called the Minutes of Evidence Project, which was able to fund the development of the performances and their presentation. So that all took about 3 to 4 years, and we're now finally seeing the fruits of it all coming out, which are the play and the book.
All right. So you just stumbled across. First of all, let me explain. You are an historian and senior research fellow in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. So
that's right.
Did you just stumble across it? You were doing other work. How did you find this Korenberg story?
I just moved to Australia. I'm Italian by birth, and I just moved to Australia. I'd gotten a scholarship to do a PhD at Melbourne University. So I was lost in the archives trying to find my way around. So I did kind of stumble upon it. I mean, I was systematically going through all the records of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. My thesis, one of the case studies in my thesis dealt with what life was like on the reserves, on the Aboriginal reserves. And so, you know, these documents were very informative, but most of them were written from the perspective of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. They were mostly reports, statistics, birth and death reports. Whereas when I came across, when I did stumble across the transcripts of this inquiry, which were published in 1882, they immediately jumped out because, as I said, you know, they contain the actual voices of the Korenberg residents. So it's a very different document. It's quite a rare document. And even though I was kind of lost in the archives, I immediately recognized that it had that it was special and quite unique. The other thing that I should mention is that when I first came across the story of Korenberg, which you rightly said at the beginning is a remarkable, amazing story, I just made the assumption that everyone knew of it. As I mentioned, I'd just arrived, moved to Melbourne. I was about 22 and kind of naively thought, well, you know, surely this is kind of the story that everyone growing up in Melbourne knows about. And I was amazed, and I still am amazed now, that it is so little known. And that seemed to me like a really great injustice, the fact that this incredible story, which is, you know, it's a story of Aboriginal self-determination and agency and independence and strength, but it's also a great story of white and black working together towards achieving justice. And so it has so much, so many lessons and so much inspiration to give today. I think anyone who knows the story will agree that it is one of the most remarkable stories. And so really that has inspired me, really. And I think everyone else who's worked on this project, who's worked so hard to get the story better known, is that it's just one of those stories that needs to be known and that, you know, kids need to learn growing up in school, basically.
Most certainly. This book should be in a compulsory reading in every school. There's no question about that. The Korenberg is part of Kulin people, the country, isn't it? The Kulin nation, Kulin people?
Absolutely, yes. And specifically, it's on the land of the Wurundjeri people. And actually, I'm talking to you today from the land of the Wurundjeri people. I'd also like to pay my respect to their elders, in particular to their senior elder, Auntie Joy Wandon Murphy, who's the great niece of William Burruck, who's the Narrangheta, or leader and spokesperson of the Korenberg community. He was the person who really brought that struggle to life and directed it right up to the inquiry and beyond. And she, Auntie Joy, who I just mentioned, has been really integral to this project. Before I began on this journey, I met her and introduced myself and told her about the idea and asked her whether she thought it would be appropriate and whether she thought that it would be good. And she was very excited and very supportive. And with her blessing, that's kind of, I kind of feel like that she was integral in making it happen, because without that support from community and from descendants, and later on through the journey, I met many of the descendants of Korenberg, it really made it, you know, it really made it feel like the project was done in the correct way. So yes, the Corindig was on the land of the Wurundjeri people, and the Wurundjeri were one of the Woiwurrung speaking clans, and the Woiwurrung speaking clans are one of the five Kulin nations of central Victoria. Mm-hmm. And Corindig was established on their lands. And it kind of contained many of the Kulin clans, but it also came to be the home for many clans from beyond that area, including Yorta Yorta, Gunai Kurnai, and also people from Tasmania and Queensland. There was a lot of people who came together at Corindig.
Okay. Now, it was a gazetted reserve, Corindig, initially purchased by the government for the purpose of Aboriginal people to live there.
Yes, so I believe 1863 is the year in which it was established, and it initially was gazetted as a temporary reserve, because the thinking of the day, as you probably know, is that Aboriginal people would eventually die out, and so these places were temporary shelters to use the word of the day, to smooth the dying pillow. And to make the last days of what was regarded as a vanishing race to be more comfortable. But actually what happened at Corindig, and not just at Corindig, but other places like Framlingham, Lake Tyres, Cummeragunga later on, these places became, they grew, and Aboriginal people formed, you know, new people were born, new kinship ties were formed, and they became very active, economically active, politically active. They became educated in European sense of acquiring literacy skills. And far from dying out, they became very successful at living in this new world order that had overwhelmed them, that had sought to take over. And so the inquiry comes about in 1881 because eventually Victorian society, colonial society, realizes, hang on, you know, these people aren't going to disappear. We'd better assimilate. You know, we'd better change the policy. Instead of containing the people, these survivors on these reserves, we'd better change the laws here and shift to a different policy. And that's what happened in the 1870s. Most of the reserves, the government in Victoria at least, started trying to shut down the reserves and to disperse and absorb the Aboriginal population into the white community. And the Corindig people, as did other communities on the other reserves, fought against this because this was their last holding of traditional land. It was their ability to remain close to country, to keep families together. And the inquiry comes about as a result of this. And it's a successful inquiry in the sense that, in the end, the Parliament votes in favour of the community by permanently gazetting the reserve. So what was initially a temporary reservation finally is made into a permanent reservation in 1884. And this, of course, is a huge victory for the Corindig community. But unfortunately, it was also a very short victory because what happened only 2 years later in 1886 is the government changed the rules of the game. They passed what is known as the Amendment to the Aboriginal Protection Act, which redefined who counted as an Aboriginal person. And they said, from this point onwards, anyone who is regarded as a half-caste under the age of 35 no longer counts as an Aboriginal person and therefore can't live on the reserves. And that law, which is known informally as the Half-Caste Act, was incredibly destructive by Aboriginal communities such as Corindig, and eventually resulted in the closure not just of Corindig but of many other reserves, Framlingham, Ebenezer, Ramayak, and so on. And so in the end, it's a tragic story, but it's also a story of success, of Aboriginal people actually managing to petition government authorities and having their rights recognised.
So with the establishment of Corindig, they were farming hops. And the hops, they were recognised as having, I think, 1876, they got the best price in Melbourne for the hops, the hops crop, the best price in Melbourne.
That's right. I believe in 1876, correct, and then 1881 they won the first prize at the Melbourne International Exhibition. They produce some of the best hops, and the irony was, of course, that Aboriginal people weren't permitted to consume alcohol, and yet they were producing the hops, which were going to making the best beer in Victoria.
All right.
And it was a very successful enterprise, and so successful that it made a lot of people in the community jealous. You know, the other farmers were, they were competing with other white farmers, and that kind of also contributed to people in the neighborhood suggesting that the station should be removed because of that.
Yes, it created some resentment, their success. And the success, these people on Corranderk, they made up, they established their own rules and laws and things for how the community would run and the farming and the sale of the hops and stuff like that. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. One of the most remarkable things about Corranderk and what makes it different to many of the other reserves is that I mentioned John Green a little bit earlier, and you also mentioned, I think, early on, he was the original manager who founded Corranderk. He was a Scottish lay preacher, and his ideas of managing an Aboriginal station were very different to those of most of the other missionaries and station managers, in that he didn't really act so much as a manager as more of an ally and a supporter to the indigenous mob at Corranderk.
Well, he wasn't paid either. He was in a voluntary capacity, I understand.
That's right. He was paid to be an inspector, which basically meant he was paid to inspect all the stations. But on top of that, he also had the role of managing Corranderk, and which he did with no salary. And his wife, Mary, also worked without salary. So they did it as a labor of love. And they certainly earned the respect of the Corranderk mob in the sense that they were willing to work with the Greens because they were treated, in John Green's words, as free and independent men. And when John Green explained to the board his way of managing the station, he explained that, you know, the laws that were made at Corranderk were made by the Aboriginal mob together with him at a court that they established. And the court included all the men and also the senior women of the community. And those laws were made, and once they were made, they were imposed. But he, in his own words, he says, you know, that was Aboriginal law. And he explained to the inquiry that he said, you know, if the Aboriginal is put into the question, he will strive to keep his own law. And that is where I consider you have failed. And those are words which really ring true today as well, I think, in terms of the way laws are made. I mean, here in Victoria, we have the Koori courts, for example, and the idea of, you know, including Aboriginal people in making these laws goes a long way towards then people actually wanting to live under them rather than being imposed from an outside sort of alien perspective.
Yes. Now, the Greens, there were some hostilities with neighbouring farmers and people in the establishment. So that eventually he was removed or terminated as the manager, which caused quite a revolt or an uprising there by the mob.
That's right.
They were very good at negotiating and petitioning and meeting and mobilising people.
Very much so. Too successful as far as the authorities were concerned. And one of the reasons that John Green was removed was precisely because of the style of management that he had, which really recognised Aboriginal self-determination and political authority. This style of treating Aboriginal people was not really accepted as being wise by the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. Which in the mid 1870s in 1874 decided that it would get rid of John Green because under pressure from vested powerful interests, which were mainly the pastoralists, the conservative pastoralist establishments that had a lot of influence in rural Victoria at this time, the Board for the Protection of Aborigines was used as a way of clearing that land. So you have people like Edward Kerr. Who became appointed themselves or had themselves appointed to the board as members, and they used that authority to get rid of John Green. Well, first they tried to get John Green to move the people from Corranderk up to the Murray River. And the Burrock famously said, Yarra is my father's country, there's no mountains for me in the Murray. He refused to move up to the Murray. And John Green refused to cooperate in the plan. He said, I will not take part in this. I know that I could convince the people to move if I told them to, because I can speak to them as men and as brothers. These are his actual words. But he will not try, because he knew that it was not in the interest of the Aboriginal people to be moved. And so the board fired John Green, or they had him expelled from Corranderk. And that triggered, as you just mentioned, a protest, a campaign, which was basically designed to get John Green back, because the Corranderk mob basically said, we don't want to have any other man here other than John Green, really the man that, you know, that we want, that we chose to run the station. We don't want someone else appointed here. And what the board did is they instead appointed a new manager who was just not fit, really, to run the station, and the Corranderk residents protested. They wrote petitions. They formed deputations, which basically meant putting on their best Sunday clothes and walking into Melbourne, which is 60 kilometres there and 60 kilometres back, which is a journey that they often carried out during the winter time, so very cold. And they walked all the way into Melbourne directly to the state premier and to voice their protests. And they're successful protests, because they got rid of the manager, and then when the board appointed a new one, they got rid of that one too. And eventually, as I mentioned earlier, Anne Bonn, this Scottish woman, got involved, and she was very powerful and had the ear of the government of the day, and that's how the inquiry came about. So this protest that started in 1875 against the removal of John Green eventually led the government to appoint an inquiry, at which the Corranderk mob testified.
And with the removal of John Green, they brought in white labour to run the farm, the hops crop, that First Nations people were running quite very, very successfully.
That's true, yes. The board actually did that even before they removed John Green. They brought in white labourers, which really upset the Corranderk community, because they saw this as their farm. You know, this wasn't a mission station or reserve for a dying race as far as the Aboriginal people were concerned. This was their farm, and they wanted to manage it on their own, well, with John Green at least. So when the white labourers were brought in, that really annoyed quite a lot of people, and they did protest against that as well. The board really didn't see Corranderk as an Aboriginal enterprise. They saw it as a place of charity and philanthropy. But when they realised that it was productive, they tried to, as you mentioned, to get white labourers in to take control of it, in order to subsidise the running of the other mission stations, which again annoyed the people of Corranderk, because they thought they should keep the money. The money should go back to the station to improve their houses, to pay salaries to the workers, etc.
Yes, most certainly. And so for an inquiry to take place, you said there was some success in that, whereby they replaced the existing manager, and then replaced that manager with somebody else after they'd moved John Green on. What was the effect? The inquiry itself, how did that... We're talking about a time where only a few years prior to this inquiry, Aboriginal people were not allowed to give evidence because of their... They may not be able to understand the oath on the Bible or some such thing. Can you tell us, is that correct? We're talking about this era, this time?
Yes, actually, as you just said, you're quite right. Until very recently, and I don't quote Mindus, but I think it was until the late 1850s or early 1860s, Aboriginal people's testimony or evidence was not permissible in court, as you said, because the belief of the day is that you have to have an understanding of the afterlife and punishment after death, hell and heaven, in order to take an oath, because otherwise the oath doesn't mean anything if you don't fear for what could happen to you after death. And the belief of the day was that Aboriginal people didn't have a concept of the afterlife, and therefore couldn't take an oath. That I think that was reversed by the time of this inquiry, but still very much the feeling or the prejudice against Aboriginal people's testimony was very present. And in fact, throughout the inquiry, a lot of the times the inquiry asks some of the white witnesses whether they believe that Aboriginal people are truthful, whether they're honest, whether what they say can be taken as evidence in a court. And a lot of people, especially John Green, say, of course they are. They've just as any person. You know, most of them are very honest, but of course, you know, whether someone does or does not tell the truth has nothing to do with the color of their skin. It has to do more with the personal character, which is just common sense. But definitely there was that prejudice, and that is why it's really important to understand that at this inquiry, the evidence of the white witnesses was very important, and it was important that it corroborated what the Aboriginal witnesses were saying, because taken on its own, the Aboriginal evidence wasn't enough to convince the inquiry. They needed the white people there to confirm and corroborate these statements, and they certainly did. Most of the white witnesses corroborated what the Aboriginal people were saying.
All right. This inquiry, the first two hearings were held actually at Corranderk?
The first two hearings were held at Corranderk, yes, in September, October 1881. And then a flurry of hearings took place in Melbourne. Then the inquiry returned to Corranderk again to get further evidence. And they went to Healesville as well and examined local settlers from the local constable, the policeman, to journalists, and farmers, and then eventually they returned to Melbourne for the final hearings. So I believe there were 10 hearings in total over a period of about 2.5 months, and the inquiry concluded in December of 1881.
Now, Corranderk was quite a substantial land holdings at this time. I mean, in 1863, it was gazetted a reserve with 2,300 acres on the 30th of June, and when John Green assumed the management position. In a short time later, there's another 2,000 or so acres purchased, 2,500 in 1866.
Yeah.
The population grew on Corranderk, and the government orders a further 2,550 acres of land reserved on the site of Corranderk. So there was almost 5,000 acres. So it was quite a substantial land holding.
Yes. Yes. 4,850 to be exact, and
yeah.
The addition was made because in the very beginning, as I mentioned, the policy was to contain Aboriginal people, and when they saw that, the original pioneers of Corranderk were Woiwurrung, Boonwurrung, Tangwurrung, Dajawurrung, Wathaurong clans, all from the Kulin Confederacy, and as the news of Corranderk spread that this Blackfellows Township, as they called it, was so successful, more and more people started to arrive. And as people arrived, marriages formed, babies were born, and so the population grew, and that's the government decided that more land was necessary in order to support that population. And you have to understand, at this time, Healesville didn't even exist. Healesville is the little township. It's still now quite a little township, but it didn't even exist when Corranderk was established in 1863. But the year afterwards, Healesville is established, and by the time of the inquiry, the population of Healesville and Corranderk are almost the same, just about 100 people. And, of course, you need land to support that amount of people. You need land for growing crops, you need for vegetables, and also, of course, for stock. And the Corranderk people kept cattle and horses, and so that land was used very productively for that purpose. However, then when the policy reversed in the 1880s and 1890s, the government started taking that land away again. So, or just as they doubled the acreage in, I think it was 1893, the government sells off half of the reserve. So all of a sudden, half of it is gone, and that also corresponds with a decline in population. And, of course, the population is declining at this stage, not because people are dying, but because that new law that I mentioned earlier, the Half-Caste Act, no longer recognises people, so-called half-castes, as Aboriginal anymore. And so the numbers and the statistics all of a sudden, there's only 50 Aboriginal people living at Corranderk, because the other 60 or 70 are regarded as no longer being Aboriginal and to be expelled from the station.
Hmm. In yes, go on.
Sorry. No, well, I was just going to mention that of course, these laws that were passed were so incredibly destructive that they are still being felt in the Aboriginal community today. This was the beginning of the stolen generation policies, because the removal of Aboriginal people from missions and reserves, of course, started with children and the separation from them and their families. And a lot of people that were expelled from the missions were thrust into an often hostile community, when even though the law didn't recognize that these people were Aboriginals, white people certainly did recognize them as Aboriginal and on that basis discriminated against them. So a lot of people who were pushed off these reserves were pushed off into poverty. There was also an economic depression in the 1890s, so there was very little work. And so this caused incredible amount of suffering. And of course, as generations went on, some of these people found it necessary to deny their Aboriginal identity in order to get by, in order not to be discriminated against. And that was incredibly destructive, of course, to Aboriginal communities. And the damage is still felt, of course, today in communities.
Yes, and that was done under the piece of legislation that was known as the Half-Caste Act.
That's right.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Certainly.
Now, there were two key issues, I think, and you can correct me, two key issues that affected, well, that brought the focus onto Colindwick. They were very, very successful. But there was also neighbouring farmers and settler society that wasn't real happy with the development of Colindwick, with blacks being there and being so successful. And with the inquiry, there was a neighbouring farmer sitting on the inquiry who actually, after the inquiry, Colindwick was broken up and sold off, and he actually ended up becoming an owner of a parcel of land that was Colindwick that adjoined his land. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Sounds like a bit of conflict of interest there. So, what would you say?
The Board for the Protection of Aborigines is one of the most corrupt institutions that one can choose to pick at this stage in Victorian politics. It is completely infiltrated from people in the pastoralist establishment. It didn't start this way. It started off with people who were, let's say, genuinely interested in the welfare of Aboriginal people, and they were more of a higher socioeconomic standing. There were often doctors or lawyers, and they didn't have a direct interest in dispossessing Aboriginal people of the land, even though, of course, all of these people's wealth was derived from stolen land. But in the 1870s, the board is taken over by pastoralists whose livelihood and whose enrichment directly derives from taking over land and certainly even at that time continue to derive from that. One of them is Edward Kerr, another is Albert Le Souef, another is Captain Page, who becomes the secretary of the board. They all have a vested interest in land, in property. And one of the most egregious conflicts of interest is that Captain Page, the secretary of the board, is a part owner in a property with Albert Le Souef, who is one of the board members. They both own a pastoralist run in Victoria. And as you mentioned, one of the commissioners on the inquiry, whose name very appropriately is Steele, John Steele. It's spelled S-P-E-E-L, but I think the pun is quite revealing. He sat on the board of an inquiry, and he was also a landowner on a property bordering Colindwick. And after the inquiry, he sought to acquire 80 acres through the board underhandedly. I don't think he succeeded then, but eventually I think he did manage to get his hands on some of the acreage once the station was broken up. So, yes, a lot of conflict of interest. And this is the kind of dodgy stuff that the Aboriginal community had to deal with. They were quite aware of these conflict of interests, and they realised that they needed their own allies in the white community in order to get by these things. And this is why William Burrock, the leader of the community, a lot of the success of that community and of their protest struggle was really forging diplomatic ties, strategic alliances with white fellas such as John Green and Anne Bonn, and they formed alliances of their own that enabled them to have people speaking on their behalf at the inquiry. So Anne Bonn was also a commissioner at the inquiry, and so was John Dow and Thomas Embling, who were also commissioners on the inquiry. So although they had enemies and people with conflicts of interest on the inquiry, they also had allies on that inquiry, and that was why they were so successful, is that they were very savvy in taking on this struggle. They weren't naive. They weren't just you know, learning the ropes. They had figured out how European politics works, and, you know, the ins and outs and the dodgy backdoor deals and bargains going on. And they took their own measures in order to counteract that. And this is why it's such a fascinating story of the struggle. Is really quite amazing, because we have to remember this time is only 50 years after the beginning of colonization in Victoria, 1835, and hardly any white fellas had set foot in Victoria. And it was only in 1835, 1836 that John Batman arrived, and then that settlement began. So 1881 is just over 50 years since the beginning of colonization. William Burrock had been born before the white fellas arrived, and he died in 1903, so he lived to see the birth of the Australian nation. And in the span of that time, he adapted remarkably to these events, surviving in the first instance and then learning to fight for his people's rights using the very techniques and tools of the colonizers, such as the written word, the petition, the deputation, forming alliances, and of course learning to use a foreign language such as English to wage this entire campaign. And so it's a remarkable story of resistance and resilience and also adaptability.
I must add, this is a little before, some years before, Patton and Ferguson and people were also mobilising down in the same area, is it not?
You've just hit on one of the many points where my historical knowledge kind of doesn't go. I'm not sure
right.
about that.
No worries. Sorry. That's all right. Now, let's take a break for a song and come back. I want to talk to you about the actual inquiry or the results of the inquiry. What happened after the inquiry? The workers, the people there, Aboriginal people went on strike or protested quite strongly. The inquiry took place. They were able to give. They were called in to make presentations. We'll come back and you can tell us about the inquiry and what it resulted in, where it went from there.
With pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Be back soon. My guest today is a co-author of Corranderk, We Will Show the Country. It's a book that's only just been published, just been released. Giordano Nanni is my guest, and the other co-writer was Andrea James, First Nations woman, Yorta Yorta woman, and it's an amazing book. You've got to get a hold of it. It's amazing. Corranderk. And there's a play about to open up in a few days' time down in Sydney, Belvoir Street Theatre. And who's in that? Jack Charles, is it? A very well-known identity down in Melbourne. And a brother from over in the West. Kelton Pell and Jack Charles are two of the two well-known actors that are performing in the play, Corranderk. And I saw Kelton only a week or two ago. There was a function down there at the Belvoir Street Theatre, and there was that. And Kelton was there for his rehearsals and stuff. My guest is Giordano Nanni, and he is a co-author of Corranderk, We Will Show the Country. It's a very newly released publication, and it's a fantastic book. Like I said earlier in the program, every school in this country should have this book. It's compulsory reading. So you better try and get a hold of it. It's a good one. Giordano, with the inquiry, what was the actual, the process of the inquiry, was it okay from the documentation that you found and saw? Were the Aboriginal people given reasonable sort of opportunity?
Look, the result of the inquiry was a success in the sense that, you know, a lot of people sometimes think that that it was a failure in the end. But the fact that they had an inquiry at all at this time is remarkable. Is a victory in itself. This is the first inquiry in colonial Victoria at which Aboriginal people were able to testify in such great numbers. We have 17 adult men and one young boy, and four women testified at the inquiry. So 22 Aboriginal people out of the 69 witnesses who testified. And it was certainly the only inquiry that came about as a result of Aboriginal people's petitioning and demands for justice and for their rights. There was a Royal Commission in 1877 and a Select Committee in 1858, but these were more appointed by the government and didn't have Aboriginal people testifying at all at the Select Committee, and only four people at the Aboriginal people at the Royal Commission. So this is it's the first, it's kind of like the first of its kind, this inquiry, and in a sense, it's a remarkable event historically, in that it didn't happen again in this regard, and it offered an amazing opportunity, really, if we look back from where we are now, in the sense that it created a space where the government, the law of, or, you know, the ruling law in that country, in the colony, heard the words of Aboriginal people and gave an opportunity, created a space where, first of all, these words, these complaints and these demands for justice, dignity, self-determination, land could be heard, and where they could potentially also be acknowledged and addressed. And in that regard, the inquiry itself is a success. The result of the inquiry initially is unclear because the government doesn't respond immediately to the report, which the commissioners write. And it takes about 3 years before the government eventually acknowledges and decides to respond. And this happens, as I mentioned earlier, with the permanent reservation of Corranderk. So it is officially made an Aboriginal reserve in trust for the use of the Aboriginal people of Corranderk. In other words, it cannot be sold. It cannot be taken down. This is the government's final word on the issue. However, as I mentioned, the passing of the 1886, the so-called Half-Caste Act, undoes this because it changes the definition of who is an Aboriginal person. So even though Corranderk is gazetted permanently for the Aboriginal people, the government now says, but hang on, you know, it depends whether you're Aboriginal. And because of these new laws, a lot of the people were classified as non-Ab or as white, even though they had strong kinship ties to country, to family, and they regarded themselves as Aboriginal or as blackfellas, as they referred to themselves in the language of the time. However, despite this, I still really, you know, emphasize the success of the inquiry. I think that it offered us a remarkable example of what can happen when white and black come together, because this inquiry came about both as a result of the activism of Aboriginal people and because white people in the community, people like Anne Bond, John Green, and some of the other people that I mentioned earlier, facilitated this this process, and they publicly supported Aboriginal people's claims to the land of Corranderk and to live there and to be treated with justice and dignity.
There was a call by Barrack, must have been a couple of years later, I'm not real sure, for the recommendations to be enacted. What were the recommendations of the inquiry?
Well, that's it's an interesting question. Basically the inquiry was split into two factions, which is very symbolic in the sense that there were those who came out of the inquiry supporting the Corranderk residents and those who came out supporting the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. So in a sense, the two groups that went into the inquiry were still divided at the end, and yet the evidence was overwhelmingly in favour of the Corranderk residents, showing that they were capable of managing the station, that they wanted to manage the station, that they didn't want to be moved, and that they wanted John Green. And the critics of Corranderk really didn't manage to prove their assertions, which were that the Aboriginal people were better off elsewhere, that they didn't mind being moved. At one stage, Edward Kerr, who was a board member says an absurd statement. He says, you know, I don't think that they would have any objection in being moved. And he believed that Aboriginal people didn't have a strong attachment to the land, and that even if they did, they would not remember it 3 months from now, because he tried to portray Aboriginal people as in an infantile and like children. He specifically says they are children. And that his words are, if I heard a child, if I saw my child playing on the brink of a well, I should remove the child even if he cried. I would remove the people from Corranderk, whether they liked it or not. So these attitudes are expressed in the inquiry. And of course, in the play, which we've put on, they hit you in between the eyes like a ton of bricks to hear these kind of statements being made now. But the result of the inquiry, sorry, to come back to your question, was that there were split recommendations. So half of the people on the inquiry, the supporters of the Corranderk mob, said at the end that the Corranderk should be permanently put in trust of the Aborigines, that the Board for the Protection of Aborigines should be relieved of its management of Corranderk entirely, and it recommended the building of a hospital, the building of new houses, the improvement of the station, whereas the other faction basically said, you know, yes, we agree that Corranderk should remain, and we agree that some improvements should be made, but if the people continue to protest and complain, they should be moved to another location far away from Melbourne, where they can't have help, you know, or where they can't be interfered with by people from the city. And by that, they meant specifically Anne Bonn and the people who were trying to help the Corranderk community.
The white do-gooders.
Yes, that's right. They tried to portray them as do-gooders who were meddling and getting involved in things that really didn't concern them.
Mm. Now, 2013, this year, is the 150th anniversary. Now, I believe the ILC, Indigenous Land Corporation, went in and bought a portion of the farm that was Corranderk back in 1998, and it still owns today by the people?
That's right. The Indigenous Land Fund purchased a part of what used to be the entire Corranderk Reserve, and I think it's now they purchased, I'm not entirely sure of the exact number, but I think it's about 200 or 250 acres, which of course is a fraction, about a 20th of the original size of the entire reserve or entire farming property. It now basically is a farm, and it contains, it still houses the original house where the manager of the station used to live. So the main building, the superintendent's building, is still there. And I believe that the caretaker who looks after the homestead and the property is Alan Wandon, who is the brother of Auntie Joy Wandon, who, as I mentioned, is the great-great niece of William Burrock. So it's still in the family in the Corranderk, in possession of the Corranderk descendants. But I believe in an Auntie Joy, I've heard her often stressing this point, that Corranderk doesn't belong just to the Wurundjeri people. It belongs to all of the descendants of all the mobs that came to live there, and that the Wurundjeri are the custodians of that place. But that they very much see it as a place that belongs to many people from across central and also greater Victoria.
And
I should also say that there was a great festival this year to mark the 150th anniversary. You mentioned quite rightly that this year is 150 years, and the Corranderk community decided to hold a festival on the very land where Corranderk was, and it was actually fantastic. There was great music, stalls, pictures, all sorts of stuff, and I think it's going to happen again next year. So if I can give it a plug, I think it's going to be the 15th or the 16th of March in 2014. If you're in the area, come down, because it's a great opportunity to actually put your feet on that land and recognise the remarkable story and pay respects to the memory of the story, and of course to it's just a thing of the past. The people of Corranderk are still here, they're still there, and they want to share the story, and so come down and meet them and enjoy the music and the day. I hope it'll be an ongoing event. I think they're certainly thinking of making it a regular annual event.
Well, it's certainly a remarkable story, and I appreciate your time in telling it. And like I said earlier, people have got to purchase this book. They've got to get out and get it. Giordano, thanks very much for telling the story today. I really appreciate your time, mate.
No problem. And hopefully, if you're in Sydney between December and January, come down and to Belvoir and see the play. It's hopefully going to tour next year. We hope that it will be used in schools to help teach the history of Corranderk in schools. And if anyone's interested out there, check out the Belvoir site. It's belvoir.com, and all the booking details are there. And hope you get a chance to see the inquiry being brought back to life by a group of amazing actors, as you mentioned, Uncle Jack Charles, Kelton Pell. It's a beautiful cast. It's an all-black cast. So it's a new development in the work. Isaac Drandich is a director. It's an incredible piece. So I hope you get down to see it.
Most certainly. It would be great to see, that's for sure. Well, thank you again, Giordano. Appreciate your time. And it's a great piece of work. It's fantastic. And alongside of Andrea James, the Yorta Yorta woman that worked beside you with this book. Yeah, we can't forget her.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Tiger, for the time. Cheers.
No worries. Have a good day. Bye now.
You too.
Giordano Nunni, one half of the team that wrote the book, Corranderk, We Will Show the Country. Andrea James of First Nations, a Yorta Yorta woman, wrote the book, co-wrote as well. It's certainly an amazing story, Corranderk. Get hold of it. Or better still, get along to the play if you get down there to Sydney. Starts on the 7th, only a few days away, runs for a little while. But time's up for me. I'll be back tomorrow. We've got an OB tomorrow. We're in town at the a launch of a health project there, IUIH, the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health. So, tune in to Let's Talk on your local First Nations station. Have a great day.